The title of this two-part series is The History of Zionism and the Zionist Left Today. In the first segments, we discussed the history of Zionism. Today, we will discuss the implications of that history on the Zionist left's role in the current political stalemate in Israel-Palestine. My guest, once again, is Dr. Barry Trachtenberg, Assistant Professor of Modern Jewish History at the State University of New York, Albany. This final segment will be a conversation rather than an interview in order to leave more room for discussion. Barry, thank you for joining me again, this time by telephone from New York.
It's my pleasure.
In our discussion today, we'll be looking at contemporary Israeli politics, politics internal to Israeli society, and specifically to Israeli Jews. While there is strong Palestinian political movement inside of Israel among the 20% of the population that are Palestinian Israelis, what we'll be focusing on today is contemporary Israeli Jewish politics and their relationship to the history of Zionism that we've discussed in our last conversation. Barry, as we have in our previous discussions, I would like to start today by having you give us a sense of how you understand Israeli politics today, and then we can dive in and try to look more closely at that picture.
I think one way to look at the Israeli left today is to understand it on a very broad spectrum. That if we perhaps go from right to left, we would start with the Labor Party itself, which came together in 1968, I believe, with the joining of several different left-of-center parties that came out of the larger Jewish labor movement that we had talked about in our earlier conversation. The Labor Party today is the Labor Party that most people associate with Ehud Barak or Shimon Peres, Yitzhak Rabin, has at times been advancing programs for peace, but is still very, very strictly within the Zionist camp. They're often identified as the Israeli left, into the way that, say, the Democratic Party is identified as the American left, in terms of general discourse within the media, I think, in popular conception. But the Israeli left is obviously much more complicated than just the Labor Party. There are several other organizations within the Israeli government, in the Knesset, that are represented, that are part of the left, such as the Meretz Party, which is a more active peace organization that works for different causes for social justice, but still understands itself to be working in the interest of the state of Israel and understands its work as preserving the vision of having a Jewish state. And then I think we can sort of go leftward from there. And you may know as much about this as I do once we start leaving the political parties and sort of move into the different peace camps and then even to the left of some of the various peace camps that are in the country today.
I also tend to think of the different parts of the Israeli left as on a continuum, and my continuum starts where yours does. The continuum that I have is kind of dynamic in the sense that once you leave those political parties, different kinds of organizations and institutions begin to show up, and I think the next one on my list would be Peace Now.
I would agree.
Do you want to?
Peace Now is an organization that was formed about 10 years after the birth of the Labor Party in 1978. I think maybe most people, certainly within the state of Israel and many of the listeners, are familiar with some aspects of Peace Now. And they may know that it was founded by roughly 350 reservists and soldiers in the Israeli Defense Force. It remains today the largest of the peace groups working within the state itself, and has chapters here in the United States and several other countries, and it's largely thought of, I think, around the world as being the major peace group that's working to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and also the largest force behind the Oslo Accord and subsequent peace efforts.
One of the things that I find fascinating about the relationship between the Labor Party and Peace Now is a similarity in how they use the term peace.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we could talk about that for a minute. When I open up a description of the Labour Party. They're working toward a comprehensive, quote-unquote, peace with security in the Middle East. And when I look at Peace Now's self-definition, it says, only peace will bring security to Israel and ensure the future of our people. For me, this is a problematic use of the word peace because it actually is being used as a means to an end, and the actual end is security.
Yeah, I think what Peace Now has is a very, very narrow and tight understanding of the word peace. Peace is clearly a tool to another end. And it has led Peace Now, and I think we have to acknowledge it has led Peace Now to often take very, very bold stances during the course of its history. You know, they're coming out in 1978, and you have a group of officers who are largely, you know, they're risking their livelihoods, perhaps risking their lives, and trying to force a shift in the dynamic of Israeli political discourse, arguing that peace and peacemaking is indeed the better way to bring about a strong Israel as opposed to war, brutality, and occupation. And so in that way, their cause seems really quite noble. What's happened, I think, though, in subsequent years since they came out with this vision, what we've realized is that they don't see peace necessarily as part of a larger project about bringing a more peaceful order to the region and to the society. What they're arguing for is peace is simply a way to strengthen the state itself. And the problem is, at least from my perspective, is that there's something inherently flawed with the state itself because it organizes itself along these quasi-religious, racial, national lines. The state that they're ultimately envisioning is one that is still going to resemble the segregationist sort of apartheid state that was created in 48.
I think the key coherence between what you're saying about Peace Now and the stance of the Labour Party is really found in this this self-definition by the Labour Party. It says, a stable peace is an important security element for the strength of the state. And in all of the things that we're saying, what I find is that peace is actually being used as a strategy as opposed to a goal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think probably for some individuals within the Peace Now movement, and probably for many of its supporters worldwide, they're actually people who believe in peace and see that this is a dominant peace group, and so they're joining it to try to bring about peace. But clearly for the leaders of the movement and the way that they've tried to use their diplomacy and their political maneuvering, it's to bring about a particular end. And I think this is really borne out that it's a tool for a particular cause, because what we find is that in the war against Lebanon in 81, many of the original members of Peace Now went to fight in that war. Many of the people who helped to form the organization just 3 years earlier signed up in the early 80s to help bring the war to Lebanon because they understood that was in the interests of Israeli security, that there was a time for war and a time for peace, and they'll pick the right tool to bring about security. That's not indicative, I think, of the entire movement, but certainly of a segment.
I understand that Peace Now takes a political position that can sometimes be viewed as contrary to the labor movement's actions in certain instances. However, what I think is useful for me in terms of finding the parallels is, and then as we move down this continuum to the left, where the shifts in political priorities come from.
I think it's important to recognize the way in which that for a time, Peace Now was largely leading the labor movement, and the Labor Party had to play catch-up to the position of Peace Now. You know, that became the alternative for the Labor Party starting in the early 90s, and then with the signing of the Oslo Accords, they finally sort of came to the Peace Now position. What happened then, I think, at that point was that Peace Now largely became irrelevant because it became the position of Yitzhak Rabin and Perez and Arafat and Bill Clinton, and no longer became anything that was subversive, no longer was anything that actually challenged the state in any kind of major way.
And having said that, actually, I think this might be a good time to share that in a 1997 statement of the Labour Party, three of the things that they were working for were, first of all, in terms of security, that the Jordan River on the far side of the West Bank would be Israel's eastern security border, and that there would be no other army stationed to the west of it. Also, in terms of borders and settlements, that Israel would extend its sovereignty over the areas where there were major Jewish settlement blocks. In terms of the right of return, the Labour Party position is that Israel does not recognize the right of return of Palestinians to areas under Israeli sovereignty. This is not different than Sharon's present stances. These are the positions that are also those of Peres and Barak.
Absolutely. And I was living in Israel during much of Barak's short tenure in office, and one of the things that was so striking was that the settlement activity not only continued during his tenure, but it actually increased during his time. So he was clearly not a man of peace.
And when you say that Barak is not interested in peace, I think, well, which kind of peace are you referring to?
That's a very good question. I was living in Jerusalem, and I went there in October of 2000, just after this intifada, when you were there. And you, I'm sure, saw the shift as well, that peace had become a very dirty word for nearly everyone involved. For Palestinians, peace ultimately meant Oslo, and Oslo meant apartheid. You know, Oslo meant the creation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip into these occupied zones in which they had less and less freedom and less prosperity. For most of Israelis, peace meant an increase in suicide bombers. You know, peace was something that was really this dirty word, I think, for many people. And so groups like Peace Now, who advocated peace, all of a sudden became these pariahs on all sides, because what they had brought about was neither a peace nor a secure society for nearly anyone involved, except perhaps, you know, the settlers, who seemed to be the groups who prospered the most under Oslo.
I want to try to tear apart some of what you just laid out there. Those are two really significant ways to try to understand how the term peace gets used in different contexts in Israel-Palestine. What was the Oslo Accords, and how was it that the Oslo Accords was supposed to be something that would move Israel-Palestine towards peace? What kind of peace?
For Israelis, I think the Oslo Peace Accord, for those who backed it, understood that the peace would mean that there would be an end to the complete militarization of Israeli society, that the threat of internal terrorism would be lessened. And they also believed, I think, that the Palestinians would have some sort of state of their own, not necessarily a full state that looked like all other states, but perhaps a demilitarized state. And I think that was in the vision of sort of the best of the people who supported it. I think for the Israeli government, what Oslo largely meant was the turning of Palestinian territories into a very, very clear client state for Israel, to be this pool of cheap labor, access to some resources, and largely having a pacified population next door who no longer posed any sort of economic or political or military threat to the existence of the state.
I think something that a lot of people are not aware of and that becomes really confusing is that during the period that the Oslo Accords were in effect, from the end of the First Intifada in 1993 until the beginning of the Second Intifada in 2000, that in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, day-to-day life actually became more difficult instead of easier. That Israeli oppression, whether that came in terms of limited water rights, house demolitions, limited freedom of movement, all of the kinds of things that have come with the occupation as it is defined in the West Bank and Gaza today, have become progressively worse and led to the outbreak of the Second Intifada.
Absolutely. I remember one day in June of 1998 when I went to go to Gaza City with some friends. And I had two very, very powerful experiences that happened that day. One was that my visa was out of date, I think, and so I was negotiating with the border guards whether or not I would be let in. And up drove a fellow named Ryland Paulson, who was at the time the head of the South African consulate to Palestine. He had an office in Ramallah in the West Bank and one in Gaza City. And I just met him about 6 weeks before in Ramallah at a friend's house. And he drove up, and he vouched for me, and so the guards let me through. Me and my friends piled into his car. And so we got a tour of Gaza City from the eyes of someone who was a member of the African National Congress, who'd worked alongside Nelson Mandela and who's very, very proud to have this post in Palestine. And there were a few things that were very remarkable about spending this time with him, and that he gave us a tour of the city and just showed us the level of deterioration that had taken place over the past 5 years, and the way in which there had been all this early optimism, and that hotels had been built, and there was a vision that Gaza would become a seaside resort and bring lots of prosperity to the community, but there were these luxury hotels that were now completely abandoned, people nearly starving in the street, enormous amounts of poverty, enormous amounts of desolation, much of which was not there before the Oslo Accords. And we didn't really fully understand why this was the case until my friends and I took a taxi and we hired a driver for a couple hours to drive us around. And we just started asking him, you know, how is your life since the onset of the Oslo Accord? And he said, without a question, it had fallen apart for him. Before Oslo, he was free to drive over all of Israel, all of the West Bank, and he was a traveling salesman. And I don't remember what it was that he was selling. But one of the stipulations of the Oslo Accords was that the Palestinian residents of Gaza were no longer allowed to leave it unless they had a very, very particular work permit.
Well, the borders that were built around Gaza were built at the beginning of Oslo, not before or after.
Exactly. And so since he wasn't given the permission to pass through the fence that had been built around it, and so he was now forced to become a taxi driver and try to figure out some way to support his family. So his life had completely fallen apart as a direct result of the Oslo Accord. And you have Israelis thinking this is a wonderful system, that, you know, that residents of Gaza are going to be building their own society in their own land, but without any real sense or desire to learn what was actually going on in the lives of these people, that it was really diminishing in very substantial terms. And it was so clear to me then in 98 that this intifada was going to occur, because the level of humiliation, the level of frustration had built up to such an extreme that it seemed that there was no way to lessen it without some sort of enormous explosion, which of course took place a couple of years later.
I was actually working in Jerusalem at the time that in the months before the Second Intifada began, and there was a very explicit sense months before of this sense of frustration and powerlessness is building to a point where it will burst, and that built until the point that Sharon took his political stance in the Old City. And yes, there was a trigger that happened there, but that there was a very strong awareness on the Palestinian side that things would not be able to remain as they were. On the Israeli side, I found really such a sense of disappointment and sadness that the peace and quiet had ended.
Yeah.
And that for me was kind of a sense of trying to grasp the differences in perception of what's happening there and the differences in this definition of peace, that the sense of Israeli sadness that the peace had ended when Oslo ended. And it was that peace and quiet of a secure situation where the Palestinian people were suffering in silence as opposed to having a voice about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that is remarkable about it is that the atrocities that were taking place in Gaza and in the West Bank, and to anyone who tried to cross the border, were well documented and well known in the Israeli press. I mean, anyone could read Haaretz in Hebrew or in English and see what was going on. And yet still there was this sense of really willed blindness, I think, but a very true blindness in a way, because the shock felt among so many left-of-center Israelis was really quite profound, that they, at some level, they just could not understand why Palestinians were rebelling against the Oslo Accord, which had done so well and so many good things for the Israelis.
And
they couldn't imagine that the Oslo Accord was built upon brutality and occupation and humiliation and dominance.
To some extent, I think that people still don't see those connections, even though where the Israeli government has picked up in terms of its oppression during the Second Intifada really is not a starting point. It's a different strategy in some ways than was going on during Oslo, but all of the different pieces that determine Palestinian lives today were going on during Oslo, whether you're talking about checkpoints and places where people can and can't go, whether you're talking about basic resources for trash to be picked up or for water to be dispersed, that all of these different elements of daily life have been under attack for a very long time. One of the responses to the Second Intifada on the Israeli side was a movement away from the left and toward the right. There were organizations that their memberships dropped. There were people who were in families that they considered left, where all of a sudden they were standing alone and their family members didn't support their position any longer. There was a sense of being betrayed by the Israeli left, that peace didn't work.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing is, I think this points to much of the sort of the fallacy of, or the illegitimacy of the Labour Party's position and the positions of groups like Peace Now, is that their idea of peace was so thin and so conditioned upon their own status of physical safety that they were blind willingly to everything else that was going on. They didn't realize, because they didn't pay attention to the fact that the Oslo Accords were systematically flawed because they brought about the complete undermining of any sense of Palestinian dignity. And they saw that the ways in which Palestinian life might be deteriorating under Oslo as glitches in the process, as almost tough luck sacrifices, as minor inconveniences in the name of this greater good that they were trying to achieve. What they didn't realize is that these minor inconveniences had built up to such a level that the entire process became completely untenable and was a fraud. And indeed, there were many people who pointed this out at the very outset. I remember reading in 1993, when these discussions were going on, articles by Edward Said and Alexander Coburn, who were talking about the fact that this is going to create prison camps for Palestinians. This is not going to bring about any type of positive change in the situation. It's only going to lead to further violence and bloodshed. And much of the Israeli peace camp was completely blind to these concerns because this was their heyday. This was their moment in the sun. And they weren't going to let any inconvenient facts and analyses, I think, get in the way of that.
What I'd like to do here is go back to the prior conversations we've had and to really try to make a link between the history of Zionism and the kinds of contradictions that you and I have discussed in this program and the position that you're talking about of the Israeli left with regard to the Oslo Accords, with regard to the situation in Israel-Palestine now.
I think that's very, very important. You know, and we can see this tendency in this trend stretching back 100 years since Oslo, that there was this always this vision among Zionists to build a fair and just society. There was always this vision among certain groups of Zionists that they were going to build some sort of utopia, of some sort of paradise. But one can see a record of compromises that took place over the last 100 years, always in favor of the particularist situation of the Jews rather than the situation of the larger peoples in the region, that constantly the rights of the indigenous population would be undercut whenever the chips were down. So from the 1890s onward, we see that young Zionists are enforcing a policy that Jews must only hire other Jews as laborers, thus displacing hundreds and hundreds of Palestinian workers, almost from the very origins of the Zionist movement in Palestine. And it's the same pattern that we see to the very day, that whenever the chips are down, the Zionists are ultimately going to resort back to this national definition of the Jews and put what they consider to be Jewish interests first over any other notions of the larger good.
Another way for me to try to understand this is that the end goal of the Zionist left and the Zionist right, it's actually quite difficult for me to see strong differences. The core difference between the Zionist left and the Zionist right is in the strategy, is in the how to go about making sure that there is a nationalist Jewish project in historic Palestine.
I think you're largely right, because the major crises seem to bear this out, that during times where things are slightly calmer in the history of the Zionist movement, we see that the debates are often very, very fierce between various parties about questions of socialism, for example, and what's the relationship between socialism and nationalism, which we discussed in our first set of talks. But ultimately, whenever the chips are down, and we saw this in this most recent intifada, there's a sense of Jews need to gather together. And so when Ehud Barak gets into power and it's the beginning of his new coalition, there's a sense of threat that's taking place in Israeli society. And although he wants to have a party of national unity, he doesn't allow any Arabs actually to be in the party, any Arab political party. It's only Jewish political parties. And this is something that's been present from the very beginning, that ultimately was when Israelis talk about national unity, they mean Jewish unity. And that is ultimately the solution that they take whenever the chips are down for Israel.
And I'm thinking of that in terms of objectives as well. Historically, we've talked, for example, of the Zionist right in the form of Jabotinsky and his explicit willingness to say, if the Zionist project is going to survive, it's going to require displacing the people that live there. That stance has extended into today's Zionist right. When I see the Zionist left, historically a denial of the presence of the Palestinian people, and then, for example, in Peace Now's statement, an acknowledgement that because the Palestinian people are here, then we need to be able to negotiate with them in order to get what we need.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it has a lot. It's not just tactics. I think it's also outlook. But certainly they're concerned with very, very similar ends, that it's about having Jewish dominance in the region. One group will choose to do this by force, often willingly and happily, if you read some of the speeches of Ariel Sharon in his earlier years, and Jabotinsky, of course. And the other group, though, is very reluctant to use force. I mean, they associate with a different trend within European Jewish history where, you know, there's this great reluctance to use force. But what we find, though, is that this group is often willing to put that reluctance behind them if necessary. I mean, they would choose to use the tactics of negotiation and compromise and perhaps political pressure, economic pressure. But ultimately what we find, even with many people associated with Shalom Achshav, Peace Now, we find that they too are willing to use force when that's ultimately necessary. Maybe more decent people that we consider have a more humane outlook. I mean, they probably recognize that Palestinians are actually human beings, but ultimately they still have the same organizing principles.
I want to read here for a moment a statement from the 1997 political platform of the Labour Party. It says, Israel's peace policy is based on the reconciliation between both peoples and their readiness to live in respect of mutual rights to self-determination and statehood, and on the superior deterrent capability and strength of the IDF.
Wow.
To me, it is just such an explicit expression of the kinds of contradictions that you and I were talking about in previous shows, where there is a moral principle, there is, well, at certain points, a socialist principle. There are these different pieces that people are bringing to their Zionism. When it comes to making decisions about how the Jewish state is going to be built and is going to be maintained, they seem to always include a willingness to deny the other people that are there.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's inherent from the beginning, and it continues to this day, you know, uninterrupted in the history of both the state and Zionism.
Let's switch gears for a minute and talk about maybe what are elements of a more just peace that you and I might include when we're looking toward solutions, ways out of these contradictions.
Mm-hmm.
The two main things that come to my mind, and they're not disconnected from each other, one is the right of return, and the other one is a discussion of the two-state solution as opposed to a one-state solution.
Sure. I think the piece that links those two is the question of nationalism.
Yeah.
You know, very much so. I don't think there can be a lasting peace, meaning a society that's created that works for the prosperity of all people in the region, if we're going to have political systems that are created along national lines.
You said that the link for you between the issue of right of return and the issue of a one-state or two-state solution is for you nationalism. I think that for a lot of people, the terms get mushy in, for example, statehood versus nationalism. Can you kind of unwind that a little bit in terms of what you mean when you say nationalism?
Sure. Well, let me also try to define it in relationship to the term state and how I'm using both of them. A state is a sovereign country that has its own borders, its own political system. States don't necessarily need to be defined by nations, which I understand to be distinct groups of people who understand themselves along national lines, that they share a common heritage, they share a common language, they often share a common affiliation to a particular piece of land. They have a common mythology about their origins and the eternal nature of their nation. So for the Jews, when Jewish nationalism began to emerge, it largely coalesced around the land of Palestine, around the notion that Jews were an ancient people from the Bible, around the idea that Hebrew was a universal language for the Jews. And this is what made them distinct from, say, the other national groups around them, like the Poles or Ukrainians or Russians or Lithuanians, all of whom had their own histories, their own languages, their own ties to a particular piece of land. And so I'm using the terms in this way. So I'm making a distinction here between Israelis and Palestinians, both of which are groups that have their own national conceptions, that they are a distinct people deserving of their own rights of self-determination, meaning, in this case, the right to have their own state, the right to have their own societies that will be for that group. For me, what I see is that nationalism is ultimately a form of chauvinism, and that it's ultimately antithetical to the notions of a lasting peace, because you're never going to have these quote-unquote pure societies made up of any one national group, and you're always going to have minorities who are going to be oppressed because they don't fit in with that particular nation. And so I think that if you're going to talk about these issues, such as the one- or two-state solution or this question of the right of return, we really have to pay attention to this question of nationalism. Because who has what right, and on what basis are we declaring these rights to exist? We have two rights of returns that we're talking about, I think we should pay attention to. One is the Palestinian right of return, right, which we're talking about a very specific group of people who were expelled in 1948 and then in subsequent expulsions that took place throughout Israeli history. These people are known, they're identified, their descendants are known, they can be identified. And without question, these people have a right to return to their homes, to their societies, or receive some sort of compensation that's acceptable to them for the loss that they and their parents and grandparents actually suffered. On the other hand, there's the Jewish right of return, which is recognized and is part of law, unlike the Palestinian right of return, which is dismissed by nearly all Israelis. And the Jewish right of return is based on this national myth, where there's a belief that the Jews who are living today are the direct descendants of the Israelites who were largely expelled from the land of Palestine by the Romans starting in the year 70, some even going back to 586 BC with the Babylonian expulsion, and that this group who's been wandering the planet for 2,000 years has a right to return. These people obviously cannot be identified, cannot make any legalistic claims that anyone would accept, and yet all Jews in the world have a right of return to this mythic homeland.
Again, we face this contradiction where Jews supporting a Jewish right of return are willing to fight and struggle for that based on the past that they acknowledge, whereas they're not willing to acknowledge the same kind of needs of a Palestinian people who is also in diaspora and also has left by force and also should have the right to return.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is at the very essence of why nationalism is corrupt. It's because it's a form of chauvinism. And that for most Israelis who believe in the Jewish right of return, there's absolutely no contradiction. Because what's central to the idea of nationalism is the notion of uniqueness, that the Jews are somehow a unique people and have suffered uniquely and therefore are deserving of unique rights and privileges that no other group is allowed to have if it's going to diminish the rights of the Jews. You know? Very, very central to this idea of Zionism is that Jews have suffered in a way that no other group has ever suffered, not just in the Holocaust, but for the hundreds and hundreds of years preceding it as well. And that somehow, if another group has to suffer for a little while to make sure the Jews are okay, that's just this necessary evil that just has to be dealt with. It can either be dealt with humanely or brutally, but it's a necessary feature to bring about a sense of redemption for the Jews.
And that, for me, is really the fundamental kind of disjuncture between the different positions of Jews about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is not the kind of strategizing of how that protection of the Israeli state should be done that happens between the Zionist left and the Zionist right, but a question of Zionist principles that play out where, as you just described, whatever does need to be done to protect the state is justified. And on the other hand, how can it be justified to do to somebody what it is that you're protecting yourself from or trying to heal from?
I mean, this is a question that many, many Jews have had to reconcile with over the last 50 years, how to be a brutal people after a very, very long period of largely being a not brutal, you know. So much of the idea of Zionism was that Judaism and the Jewish people themselves were somehow corrupt and in needing of complete reform, you know, a complete overhaul. That there had to be this idea of a new Jew, and the new Jew was going to be tough and strong and brave and do all the necessary evils that it took to keep the Jewish people alive.
I find it ironic that along with that kind of mythology that has been created of the new Jew, there is also kind of carrying along with it and parallel to it an image of the eternal victim.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's the justification for these extra legal actions that the state constantly takes. You know, I think there's two important ways to look at the state of Israel in our day and age and for much of its history. One is as a client state of the United States and serving the interests of U.S. imperial ventures in the region. But on the other hand, it's often a renegade state. It will often act all on its own for its own good. And so as much as the United States manipulates Israel and Israeli politics, Israel tries to manipulate that relationship also for its own good and for its own purposes. And so this is why Israel can get away with such crime that only superpowers can get away with. You know, they can have 100 nuclear weapons, not acknowledge them, and not be subject to international law regarding nuclear weapons. You know, they can engage in torture and brutality and occupation in defiance of UN codes, and nobody's there to enforce. I wonder if we can change the focus of our conversation a bit. I mean, both of us were living in Israel during the beginning of this most recent intifada. But you've actually spent more time in the country than I have in the last few years. So what do you see as the lay of the land today of the groups who are perhaps left of Peace Now and the Labor Party?
Left of there are many organizations active, such as B'Tselem, the Coalition of Women for Peace, Gush Shalom, Indie Media Israel, Machsom Watch, New Profile, the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, Bat Shalom, Rabbis for Human Rights, Tayush, Wilf, Women in Black. This is just a quick list without going into too much detail. Some of them tend to be more humanitarian than political. B'Tselem is a human rights organization. Rabbis for Human Rights, they do tend to get involved in political projects. They're largely working toward humanitarian efforts. Tayush, I'm fairly certain the name means together, and it is indeed Palestinian Israelis and Israeli Jews working together. As far as I'm aware, they have actually not taken a political position, but organized actions that one would assume are coming from a very political standpoint. But I think they're presenting themselves as a humanitarian organization. The list goes on. I won't take time to describe them all. What I want to try to do is to say that I think these are organizations that do sit further left of Peace Now in that they try to undo the normalization of oppression that was so active and present during the Oslo period. They take on issues of what it would mean to share Jerusalem, actually advocate for that, take on issues of serving in the military and really support people that refuse to serve. They stand at checkpoints and kind of bear witness of what's happening and how people are being treated at the checkpoints and also in prisons. I would suggest that another kind of step to the left from these organizations is another set, such as Kvisa Shchoa, which is the Gay and Lesbians Against the Occupation, Peula Amamit, which involves workers, Prisoners Coalition, Women on Behalf of Political Prisoners, Yesh Kavul, and the Israeli Coalition Against Home Demolitions. These organizations, and it's very difficult and perhaps unsafe to kind of try to make these distinctions. I would actually be interested to do more research and really, really kind of flesh out the kind of dynamics going on in Israeli political organizations. I would say that these are organizations that explicitly acknowledge and reject the unequal power relations between Israel and the Palestinian society. They are willing to name Israel as the oppressor. Yet underlying those arguments, there still seems to be a coherent Zionist history that either sees or seeks a viable Jewish democratic state. I may be overstepping some bounds there for a couple of the organizations, and maybe my categories are not as they should be. I know that the Israeli Coalition Against Home Demolitions takes very strong positions on many issues. Yesh Gvul takes very strong positions on many issues, but their name means there is a border, there is a limit. And in addition to them implying that there's a limit to the lack of justice that can be served, the name also implies a two-state solution. And then if there is a two-state solution, that suggests the viability of a Jewish state as well as a Palestinian one.
And what are you using to decide who's to the left of groups like Peace Now? Like, what's the criteria for determining where these different groups sit on a continuum? I mean, for me, it's often around these two issues that you mentioned earlier. Where do these groups stand on the right of return for Palestinians, and where do they stand vis-a-vis a one-state solution? Or is a much different spectrum than groups normally are used when you talk about left and right.
I agree with you, and I think it's important to be really explicit about that. In the middle ground where I'm talking right now, I actually find that there's been a variety there in terms of where organizations stand on the right of return. I think that there's more consistency in terms of their support of a two-state solution. However, they sit left of Peace Now and the Labor Party in terms of their rejection of kind of the simplistic dialogue between the Zionist left and the Zionist right of either attack or negotiate, that there is more of a sense of what are the actual moral issues involved, what is the definition of a just peace, that they're willing to kind of engage more deeply in those discussions. However, they're still sitting in a place that supports a two-state solution of a Palestinian state sitting beside an Israeli state.
Yeah, can I interject one piece?
Uh-huh.
I think perhaps I would take it even just a little bit further in that groups like Women in Black and Gush Shalom believe deeply in a viable Palestinian state. And the key word, I think, is viable. Like, I don't believe that the Labor Party believes in a viable Palestinian state. But I do believe that people like Uri Avneri and Gush Shalom, you know, he does believe that the Palestinians deserve to have a state as viable as the state of Israel is. And in that sense, they recognize the humanity of the Palestinians, but they also are still maintaining this otherness of the Palestinians, that they are a separate, distinct people from the Jews.
I think that the sense of working toward nationalist struggles is kind of built into the history of the place. Stepping out of that is really difficult. I also problematize the idea that there is such a thing as a viable Palestinian state. From what I've seen of the West Bank, from what I've seen of Gaza, from what I have studied, from what I have heard from people on both sides of the Green Line, there is no viable state. I've talked with Palestinian officials. I've talked with people living without water. Where that viable state is, I don't know. In terms of borders, in terms of the wall currently being built, in terms of access to water, in terms of contiguous areas of land where people can just simply move from their sister's house to your house, I don't see it.
Why do you think that these groups then, like Gush Shalom, Women in Black, why do you think that they still embrace this notion that there can be a viable Palestinian state alongside an Israeli state? Why do you think they still hold on to this notion? I mean, some do it because they're Zionists, but I'm not sure even if all the figures understand themselves to be Zionists.
I think that discussions about how to think about the conflict in Israel-Palestine have shifted over time, and there have been historically discussions of a one-state solution, whether it's by the UN resolutions, whether it's by clear Israeli refusal to discuss a one-state solution, that the kind of conversation has been defined that if there is going to be a solution, it's going to be a two-state solution.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that can be positive in the sense that that gives people something to talk about and work toward. But in terms of a strategy, I find it frustrating in the sense that if there is no viable state for me to see there, then what am I really working toward? And it ends up for me that working towards a two-state solution feeds into the kinds of strategies that people have offered up in the Oslo Accords, in the Geneva Accords. I don't see how that leads us away from the conflict and into something more positive.
Let me ask you another question, because this is something I've not always been very clear on. You know, I'm someone who is opposed to organizing a state, really any state, along national lines, that members of any nationality have any sort of specific rights or responsibilities over people of any other nationality. But people often on the left talk about a binational state. I tend to move away from that term because I get concerned that it's still reinforcing the national identities of the two groups and that it will keep the tensions between the two groups fully in place. And so instead, I tend to talk about just a one-state solution where nationality isn't the defining characteristic of the state itself, or nationalities are not the defining characteristic of the state itself. What do you make of that distinction between one state and a binational state? Often I think that the terms are used synonymous with that. I don't understand them.
Radha Karmi has actually written an extremely useful article on this topic. In a binational state, Jews and Palestinians would coexist as separate communities, but in a federal arrangement. Each people would run its own affairs autonomously and be guaranteed the legal right to use its own language, religion, and traditions. Both would participate in government in a single parliament, which would be concerned with matters of supracommunal importance, such as defense, resources, the economy, and so on. Such a state would be modeled on the cantonal structure of Switzerland or the binational arrangement of Belgium. In the Palestine-Israel case, the country structure would be based on the present demographic pattern of the country, where densely Arab-populated areas like the Galilee would become Arab cantons, and Jewish ones like Tel Aviv would be Jewish cantons, and so on. The democratic secular state, on the other hand, envisions a one-person, one-vote polity without reference to ethnicity or creed. It would aim to create an equitable, pluralist society on the Western democratic model and is opposed to the arrangement of separate communities. From a standpoint of identity politics, a binational solution is a way of acknowledging difference and acknowledging differential access to power and how that really plays out in people's daily lives, and therefore building into state structure the kinds of checks and balances that would be needed to make sure that the state is being accountable to the various groups mm-hmm. involved.
And so do you see that there are groups out there that are promoting a vision of the region that includes these two notions that I think we both agree are so essential, that there needs to be ultimately one state that's going to incorporate everyone, as well as a recognition of the rights of Palestinians who are now in exile to return? Because these seem to be the two sticking points that, in my mind, separate sort of a more legitimate left than an what I would think of as a more illegitimate left.
Yeah, as we move further left on that continuum on the left, there are organizations, and historically there have been. The oldest organization that fits the kind of description you've given is Matzpen. Matzpen is known to many as the most radical left group in Israeli history. Matzpen is actually the name of their newspaper, but it's the name that stuck. They were formed in 1962 by leaving the Communist Party. They worked for 10 years as internationalists, anti-capitalists, and anti-Zionists. They became most well-known in 1967 in their opposition to the 67 war, and became quite well-known considering their very small numbers. In its place now are other groups that are connected to the same founders of Matzpen and are connected to the same ideologies. Of course, it becomes much more complex, but I think that there has been kind of a historical line on the radical left inside of Israel. I think there are much smaller numbers, as well as perhaps deeper or more thoroughly applied analyses of the conflict in an international context, emanating from the socialist histories of both Israel and the PLO. And these histories include efforts toward a one-state solution. Socialist organizations that are involved at this point are the Israeli Communist Forum, the Alternative Information Center, the Fourth International, or the Socialist Workers League, and Between the Lines. I think at the same kind of point on the spectrum there, on the left, as opposed to the socialist left, there's the anarchist left. And again, I think that there's a deep analysis of the conflict, which is made in an international context and from an anti-authoritarian and anti-nationalist perspective. And these organizations include the traditional anarchist organizations that are working today, such as the Black Bloc and Class War, in addition to new groups such as the Anarchists Against the Wall.
So where can activists and potential activists who reject the discrimination, I think, and segregation that's at the heart of many groups like Peace Now, where do you think can they turn for information, for places to lend their support?
General news from the region that I think is very useful is Egypt's weekly Al-Ram. In English, it's available at weekly.ahram.org.eg. Also, Al Jazeera is available in English at english.aljazeera.net. It's english.aljazeera.net. Information about what's going on in Israel-Palestine can be found at the Electronic Intifada, which is at www.electronicintifada.net, all one word. The Alternative Information Center also has a website at www.alternativenews.org, which is all one word as well. And here in the U.S., Counterpunch covers the issues in Israel-Palestine quite well, and they're at www.counterpunch.org. For in-depth analysis that I find some of the most useful of all, I would direct people to a paper that's published in English called Between the Lines, and it's actually not being published currently just for lack of funds and energy, but it is an extremely important paper, and I hope they begin to publish again. Their back issues are available at www.between-lines.org, and they are Palestinian and Israelis together publishing in English incredibly important analyses of what's really happening on the ground. And for specific campaigns, I would like to direct people to Stop the Wall, www.stopthewall.org, which is a community-based organizing effort that is really driving the campaign against the wall. El Alda, working toward the right of return for Palestinians. El Alda has a Los Angeles branch for people that are here in LA, and it can be found at www.al-awda.org/Los Angeles. And the last one I'd like to mention is about the divestment campaign that has been growing over the last 2 or 3 years, I think. It's available to see at the internet at www.sustaincampaign.org, all one word. Let's bring that back to our whole point for meeting here. We wanted to discuss the implications of the history of Zionism on the Zionist left today. And it seems that what we've been finding is that the contradictions built into Zionism, or that have been expressed through the history of Zionism, are still present today. Do you see hope for either overcoming or unraveling those contradictions, or moving past them somehow, or moving through them somehow?
I don't think that one can be Zionist and of the left at the same time. I don't know if that... I'll leave the question aside of whether or not that was possible at one point in history. I don't think it's at all possible now, if we understand that to be on the political left means believing that all human lives are of equal value and of equal worth, and that you work to bring about policies that guarantee that. That's what it means to be on the left, and that's what it means for me to be on the left. It's absolutely impossible to maintain that position and to be a believer in Zionism.
Let me ask you a question that I imagine many listeners might be wondering. If you and I as Jews are taking the position that we are on the state of Israeli-Palestinian politics and the history of the Zionist left in helping to get the situation to the point that it is, or being implicated in it, what are we really saying about what we want for the future of the state of Israel?
What I'm saying is I want to see the fundamental transformation of the state of Israel, and that I believe that both to be in the interest of the Jewish people and in the interest of all the people who live in the region.
What does that mean, a fundamental transformation?
What I mean is that a fundamental transformation to a democratic society. Because although Israel has elections and although many Israelis vote, it's very, very far from being any sort of democratic society. It's clearly a democratic society only for the Jews, and in very narrow terms. Israel is an incredibly hard place to live as a free person because the state is set up to be a multi-tiered society in that Jews, and indeed certain Jews, have special rights and privileges over the rest of all other inhabitants of the state. Many people are denied citizenship, though other people are given a version of second-class citizenship. This is ultimately, and I look at this from the point of view of Jewish history, because that's my field and that's often my outlook, but this is a terrible thing in Jewish history. Because what it ends up doing is it turns the power to define what it means to be Jewish over to the state. It reduces Judaism, which has been this very, very varied expression of a people, and reduces it to a nationalistic conception that doesn't allow for any other variation. And this is a very bad and dangerous course that the Jewish people are on. It has turned us into persecutors. It's turned us into barbarians. It's turned us into a very brutal people for the first time in our history, in a long history. We're on the side of the occupiers. We're on the side of the oppressors and the persecutors. And it's not a noble place to be.
Thank you very much. I think if there's one thing that I would want to try to kind of summarize with and leave people with would be to be cautious of supporting the left if its political goals are contrary to your own. What the left is and what I might want it to be may be two different things, and that may be for other people as well. Those are painful contradictions to try to make sense of, but that in doing so, I think we fulfill our obligations to ourselves as well as to other people that are implicated in varying degrees in this conflict. Barry, I want to thank you so much for the time that you've spent with me here in discussing these issues.
You're welcome, and thank you for inviting me to be a part of this conversation.
This program is dedicated to the public domain. Please feel free to copy and share this program with others. It is available for free download at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. I would like to give a special thanks to the following people who helped make this program possible. Of course, Barry Trachtenberg for his time and dedication to the project. Also, Alan Minsky for suggesting and initiating the idea. The KPFK production staff for their engineering assistance. The members of the short-lived group called the Pondering Jews for their support. Jessica Lawless and J.J. Day for their support. And Dave Adelson of the L.A. Sound Posse for technical and editing assistance. Thanks very much for listening.